Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Thank you very much for the invitation from EAN for this podcast. The title of this podcast is Carpal Tunnel Syndrome Detected by Ultrasound. As you know, ultrasound moved a lot of improvement in the last time. We just have some other topics about ultrasound, and we specifically are oriented to the peripheral system. I'm Pier Giorgio Lochner. I'm professor of neurology at the University of Hamburg, Germany, and I perform ultrasound from out in inpatient clinics. A very important and guest, a friend of mine, is Stefan Schreiber, professor of neurology at Charité Berlin, a very good expert of ultrasound. And I would ask him, how are you? Can you tell me something about you, Stefan?
Well, thank you very much, Pier Giorgio, for the introduction. Welcome to the listeners. As you've already heard, so there's two professors of neurology sitting here today that want to talk about carpal tunnel syndrome. So in fact, besides working as a general neurologist and being the head consultant of a neurology department in a district general hospital, ultrasound has been really one of my focus points. And I'm actually teaching neurosonology for more than 25 years within the German Ultrasound Society, the DIGUM, and also as a longstanding member and actually currently also as an executive committee member of the World Organization of Neurosonology. So teaching of ultrasound in all sorts of formats is quite familiar to me, but this one as a podcast, this is new. So we have only words, we have no images. So I'm trying to explain things as in detail. So as if you would look onto the screen, we will see. I'm looking forward to this format.
Okay, thank you. This is very interesting and a sympathetic introduction from you. I thank you. And then coming to this topic, can you explain me for listeners, what is carpal tunnel syndrome?
Yeah, I think that's a good introduction question. So what are we talking about with this condition? So it's a chronic disease, chronic focal compression neuropathy. So it's something that affects the peripheral nerve, the median nerve. The median nerve is one of the three long nerves running from the brachial plexus to the wrist. And during its course in the wrist, it runs underneath the transverse carpal ligament or flexor retinaculum. And it does this together with the flexor tendons. And so these are the tendons that bend your fingers and your wrist. So actually, if you try that, you make a fist and you bend your fist, you will see that these flexor tendons pop out. And for them to not pop out too very strong, there's this retinaculum that prevents to do that. And the nerve actually passes underneath this retinaculum, this band together with these tendons. So whenever we move our fingers or the wrist, the nerve is also being moved. And now you can imagine that in case of overstrain or some local compression or mechanical strain, the nerve starts to get symptoms. And then these kind of symptoms might start with like paresthesias, so tingling in the fingers quite frequently at the night, nocturnal paresthesias. And affected are those fingers that are provided by the median nerve, which is the palmar surface of the thumb, index finger, the middle finger, and the radial half of the ring finger. So these are the kind of sensory symptoms that show up with carpal tunnel syndrome. And then there also might be motor affection because it's a combined nerve. So this is the TINA muscle. So it's the muscles responsible for opposition and abduction and flexion of the thumb. So that might be impaired. So in the worst case scenario, you have a combination of sensory tingling, painful tingling, and muscle weakness. And that might quite strongly affect the patient and impair like day-to-day activities like gripping, holding objects, fastening buttons, or even just sleeping through the night because you have these painful sensations in the fingers.
Absolutely, I understand. Very clear, detailed explanation. A question for me is one condition that affects a lot of people, and moreover, do you have some predisposing factors, such as age or other factors that could predispose to the patient to have this syndrome?
Right. That's a very good question. Yes, because it's actually really relevant. About 15% of the global population actually suffer from carpal tunnel syndrome during their lifetime. It frequently affects middle-aged people, women more than men, more elderly than the younger patients, and there is like an incidence between 3 to 10 cases per 100 person per year. So it's quite a relevant condition. And asking the question of risk factors, of course, there are any mechanical strain, any special work that overactivates your hands and your hand function might lead to such a condition. And in some countries of the world, it's actually recognized as an occupational disease, carpal tunnel syndrome. It is not only the elderly and not only occupational. There's also other conditions that predispose to carpal tunnel syndrome. So in the young female that are pregnant, for instance, in the third trimester, there's some fluid retention in the tissue, and that leads to local compression and carpal tunnel syndrome. There's other conditions like hypothyroidism, diabetes, and then a big group that is also related to carpal tunnel is trauma. Trauma, of course, distal arm and wrist trauma, and in particular because it's so common, distal radius fracture. So in this kind of condition, we also frequently see carpal tunnel syndrome.
Quite interesting, but I have another question. And if you don't have these patients that are characteristically at risk, do you have some red flags by some patient, if you have a young patient or patient with bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome? Can you explain that?
Bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome. Well, then, of course, it makes you think about conditions that are more general and not only some local compression. Of course, there's some hereditary condition, hereditary neuropathy with compression palsies, this kind of thing. There is also conditions that are inflammatory peripheral nerve disease that might involve in this kind of way and manifest its way in this field. So yes, indeed, one would think more globally and more general kind of disease rather than a local single compression. Yes, could also be.
Okay, and is there any systematic condition that could be recognized by this syndrome? In the young patient or in the older patient, and it would be very interesting to suspect that. I remember that in one situation, we just diagnosed amyloidosis, but bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome. So I think it's very important also to recognize these red flags or mucopolysaccharidosis. Yes, okay?
Yes, I do agree. Yes, I do agree.
Okay, perfect. But now, if you have the patient with the clinical symptoms and you have your suspect, what you are you doing? You are performing examination, anamnesis, history, or you move to the neurophysiological point of view, or you make something more. What is your way to diagnose this syndrome?
The approach, of course, to do it all. And of course, we always start with anamnesis. So we need to talk to the patient, listen and see what the complaints are and if they fit the kind of complaints that I was talking about earlier. And then the next step is a clinical look at the patient. So we do not start with technical stuff. We look at the patient, we palpate the tina, we look for atrophy. We test the sensation in the fingers. There's some special testing there, compression test, if you want, where you try to challenge the nerve. So the Phalen test is one where you angulate the hand strongly and to see if you can cause any tingling in the fingers, some sensory symptoms, or more directly, you can compress the retinaculum, Hoffmann-Tinel sign, and see if it causes any sensation, and the medianos provided fingers. So that would be sort of the start. Of course, you look for motor function, you see if thumb abduction opposition works, something like that. And then the next step, in fact, is still not yet imaging. It would still be electrophysiology. So nerve conduction would be the next step to look for. And in a classical carpal tunnel syndrome, we would expect a slowing of nerve conduction in the nerve conduction studies. So the classical electrophysiological parameter is distal motor latency that we measure. So there's a stimulus about 6.5 centimeters away from the wrist, and then you measure time until the muscle twitches, and a distal motor latency more than 4.2 milliseconds would be pathological. There's other conditions we can add. So there's the nerve conduction, sensible nerve conduction, and the nerve conduction that you can also compare to the ulnar nerve that runs parallel and, of course, does not run underneath the retinaculum flexorum, so it's not affected. So you can do side-to-side comparisons. So, and if the conduction velocity side-to-side ulnar versus median is, the difference is more than 8 meters per second, then you can, with high sensitivity and specificity, differentiate your carpal tunnel syndrome. And if you all have all these things together, then of course everything is very suggestive for the carpal tunnel. But then what you do not have at this point is no information on nerve structure, nothing. You don't know what the nerve suffers at the local point. And this is where imaging comes in.
Yes, that was the next question, because I mean, you have all this information, you can, treat the patient, but you have to add something more. And this is the point of, I think, ultrasound coming. What do you suggest in this way?
Yes. If we talk about imaging, of course, in medicine, we have our classical radiological imaging like X-ray and CT. That's of no use if we look at soft tissue. So that drops out of the options. There's MRI imaging that has a problem with spatial resolution, in fact. So it's good for soft tissue, but spatial resolution is not good, and this results in low sensitivity and specificity. And that actually ends up with the ultrasound, because this is an ideal approach to look at soft tissues where you need high spatial resolution. And when you want to get some specific information on a structure like a nerve. So the next ideal step to choose would be ultrasound.
Protocol on the, you need some probe or frequency, new models. What do you suggest for the new user for ultrasound?
Yes, indeed, there's some things to consider for the ultrasound system. So it should be an ultrasound system that is optimized for near field insonation. For nerve sonography, we usually use linear probes, so to not distort the image. And while comparing to, for instance, vascular imaging at the neck, we have like 7 to 10 to 12 megahertz probes. So if we talk about nerve ultrasound, we want 12 to 18, or perhaps even up to 24 megahertz of insonation frequency. So the higher the frequency, the better the spatial resolution, but also the more near the surface, the insonation depth will get smaller. And if you do that and look at the median nerves, and then you get quite some impressive imaging, because we look at the nerve commonly in the cross-sectional area, and the nerve in cross-sectional area, the median nerve, has a nice, we say, honeycomb appearance. So it's still dots that you can see, and the dots, the fascicles, are surrounded by a hypoechogenic epinorium. And this is actually something important to notice. So the ultrasound system providers, they have all sorts of post-processing of the B-mode images. And what you should make sure is to get nice image, of course, but you should be able, with your B-mode post-processing, to see this honeycomb structure. So some of the techniques post-processing lead to that you don't see any dots anymore, but you see stripes or bars instead of the dots. So you need to adjust that to really get the true image and to see the fascicle.
Oh, quite interesting, I mean. But for the new users, do you think there is, they needed a lot of experience? Second, what kind of signs do you see in patient who has Capitulin syndrome? I mean, is any swelling or other anomalies that you recognize?
Yes, actually, there's a lot of structural things that we can see with the ultrasound. But first, just say, what are the challenges? I think it's a technique that is easy to learn. Of course, it needs some guidance at the start, and now we cannot show that with images. We just have to describe it. But it's quickly to be learned. And of course, if the ultrasound system has good settings, as we've just been talking before, then it's very, very easy. If you just take your probe that you use for the carotid artery insertion, then it might be more challenging to see all the structures that we'll be talking about right now. So, but it's easy to learn. So I would say go for it and and look for the nerve ultrasound. I would encourage you and not stop you to do that. So what do we see in the ultrasound? So, and what kind of pathological findings are there? Why would we do the ultrasound in addition to the just clinical and electrophysiological studies? Because there's a lot of things to be seen at the compression sites. So at the compression site, for instance, there's anatomical variations. So the median nerve often is a single nerve at the level of carpal tunnel, but sometimes in patients, it's already a bifid nerve. So it splits into two branches. And in these cases, but also without the bifid anatomical variant, there's frequently a prominent arteria mediana, median artery. So that's anatomical knowledge that perhaps a surgeon might want to know before opening the place and decompressing retinaculum. More importantly to seeing all these anatomical variations and also pathological conditions near the nerve is the reaction of the nerve to the local compression itself. So nerves, if they have local irritation, react with swelling, very commonly react with swelling. And we see the actual swelling with the ultrasound. And that's proximal and distal to the actual compression site. For this, we have actually normal values. So we can look at the cross-sectional area and see, for instance, that from a cross-sectional area from a certain number onwards, this argues in favor of carpal tunnel syndrome or not if there's no swelling.
So do you have some cutoff value that are confirmed by electrophysiological examination, or you only consider the swelling from this pathological median nerve compared to the other nerve, which is your experience?
Yes. Yes, we have normal values, but there's a challenge there because the normal values run on a so-called receiver operating curve, ROC curve. Let me explain that in detail. So if we take a cutoff value of, for instance, 12 square millimeters, then almost every patient that is symptomatic that has more than 12 square millimeters actually has a carpal tunnel syndrome. So specificity is really high, but sensitivity at the same time is not very high because a lot of people have a carpal tunnel syndrome with a cross-sectional area of only 11 square millimeters. So if we reduce to 11 square millimeters, then specificity gets lower, but sensitivity is getting higher. So a lot of people have with 11 square millimeters cross-sectional area, also carpal tunnel syndrome. So depending on what lab settings are, most of the lab settings start with a cross-sectional area more than 10 or from 11 square millimeters onwards as a start with that. And they add one other additional information that is called the wrist forearm ratio. So what we do there is we compare the swollen nerve with a more proximal part of the nerve. So we go to the lower forearm, 10 to 12 centimeters proximal of the wrist, and measure cross-sectional area, build a ratio. So usually that should be around 1, so it doesn't change a lot between the forearm, the cross-sectional area, and the wrist. In pathological conditions, if the ratio is more than 1.4, and you have the cutoff level of 11 square millimeters, then you get a very high sensitivity and specificity. Applying these to the cross-sectional area and the wrist forearm ratio, we are reaching with ultrasound sensitivity and specificity up to 90%. So that's for a diagnostic modality quite good.
Very clear explanation. I would think all these information are to get together with the clinical context and the electrophysiological examination as well. But did you have any surprises when you are doing ultrasound? Do you discover other pathological condition outside the carpal tunnel syndrome? Or I have another question for me. Do you have some protocol that combine in your examination the nerve and the muscle innervated by the nerve?
Yes, we actually have not yet spoken about the sort of the local protocol, and that actually involves answering this question. So perhaps for those to understand how the setup is, the routine protocol in my lab is what I would, for carpal tunnel, I would study the patient in the sitting position. So the patient would sit in front of me. I have the patient have a supporting cushion on the lap, and the hands and wrists are resting on the supporting cushion. And then on my protocol, I'm actually really not starting with the nerve. I'm starting with the muscle. Why? Because muscle is sort of my substitute for the EMG, right? Because if there's relevant axonal damage, the muscle changes and alters. Of course, there's atrophy in this condition. We already talked about atrophy, but also in axonal damage, there's changes in echogenicity of the muscle. So the muscle gets brighter. So I get a quick idea looking at the muscle, at the TINA muscle, hyperechogenic changes or not, as indirect signs of axonal damage. And then I just change to the nerve. And then where would you start identify the nerve? So reading about it a lot, recommend to look at the nerve and start at the forearm, because there the nerve is nicely visible between the flexor muscles, flexor digitorum superficialis and profundus. The muscles are relatively dark and the nerve with the honeycomb structure is bright. I myself really start directly at the carpal tunnel level, at the level of the os pisiforma. And then I'm actually following the nerve. I'm looking for swelling at the wrist and more distally, but then I'm not stopping there. Although the question is only carpal tunnel, I'm going far up, more proximal the nerve. I'm going through along the forearm to the cubital fossa and even to the upper arm, close to the axilla. Of course, it's easy to follow the nerve. And then talking about surprises, yes, one can get surprises because sometimes, well, we have inflammatory neuropathies where you have swelling of the nerve, not at the carpal tunnel, there's everything fine, but you see swelling in a non-compression site. So we're talking about neuralgias that go along with nerve swellings. And so, yes, this kind of surprise might show up. And of course, you do not want to operate somebody on carpal tunnel syndrome if the problem is actually inflammatory and in the upper arm.
Interesting and clear explanation. I mean, without images, you explain us how can you do real very good protocol, an overview of the nerve and more. And is any new developments of ultrasound in the last time that could be showed by you or described by you shortly?
Yes, there's development going on. Although I want to start with something important. Before we talk about the new developments, we should really keep in mind that not even every patient that goes for operation gets actually the imaging, the structural imaging with the ultrasound. So imagine any other operation from carpal tunnel. Would you let the surgeon operate on you without having done any prior imaging? I think not. And that's something we should also get into practice for our patients. So there's, even in this very basic approach to do it, something to be done. But now to the question of any new developments. Of course, there's lots of interesting developments going on that's related to new techniques that are available, new ultrasound techniques. So, for instance, there's the option to do elastography, so you can actually check for the rigidity of a tissue. And that's also something that you can apply to the nerve. So an affected nerve will have a sort of change of hardness. And that's possible to visualize with ultrasound approach if you have an elastography feature. Then if there's some affection of the nerve there, usually there's change in vascularization. So there's new modes of vascular imaging, color flow imaging, that allows more easily and more impressive vascularization in this region. And perhaps even more important is the very common nowadays popping up keyword artificial intelligence. And of course, artificial intelligence is relevant and will be even more relevant in terms of image processing, in image evaluation. And so far, our measurement of whether the nerve is swollen or not is still manually. So we encircle the hypoechogenic nerve with a honeycomb structure. We do not include the hyperechogenic epinorium. We just stay underneath. We do it manually with our trackball. So AI will be a really great help to do these kind of image analysis and will make it much easier to measure the cross-sectional area. However, so far, and to my awareness, there's no commercial machine that is sort of directly applying this kind of AI image analysis, but that will come and it will be of great help. And perhaps also the combination of the image processing on one side, together perhaps to put in with the clinical information. So in such an AI system, I could give in clinical information, I can give electrophysiological information and the imaging of the nerve. And that might help to get sort of more focused and individualized decision strategies of what to do conservative treatment or interventional treatment.
Absolutely correct. And I will thank you for your clear explanation. So if I just summarize what we have spoken about, carpal tunnel syndrome is a very often condition affect fast 5% or more of the population, 15, depends on the age. There are characteristic risk population. But we have to look after red flags in carpal tunnel syndrome, and not only based on clinical history, but also examination and electrophysiology. We have another possibilities, ultrasound. And ultrasound can be done in the diagnosis and then after the therapy to control the work of the operator if the carpal tunnel syndrome is operated as well. So, and as new neurologists, we have to be curious and then to see the anatomy. There are more possibilities for the future for ultrasound. I would thank you, Stefan, for your very clear discussion. And of course, Ian. And I hope that with this podcast, new inputs for ultrasound came to us. Bye-bye.
Thank you. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.